My name is David Bella, and this session is going to be a science fiction story, or maybe I should say a technology fiction story. As I told you, it was developed by me for engineers. Okay? And it's to deal with the limitations of technology and what questions come up. Now, technology, for many decades now, has been a subject of controversy, particularly with regard to the environment and will it cause problems in the environment. And if you look at most of the work that's been written on criticizing technology, they're criticizing it because, oh, it won't work right. You know, you're liable to cause more pollution problems. Well, what happens if technology really works? Then what? Do the problems all go away? Let's suppose we eliminate pollution, we eliminate war, we eliminate all of this. Does that mean the problems go away? What I want to get across through this story is no, that's not the case. Technology really works in an all-encompassing way. There are some real problems that are still here. Okay, I'm going to tell you a story, and when you're told a story, what you try to do is just get involved in the story. And I have to remind engineers to do that, because engineers analyze stories and figure out, you know, as the detached observer, that's your objective analysis. You don't want to do that. You want to get involved and participate in the story. Okay? And then we'll see what happens in the story. And then we'll talk a little bit about it. This is a story about the future. And it is told by some character who's somehow, for whatever reason, stumbled across the future world. And they are describing, this character is describing to us this future world. Okay? So listen to the character speaking. All right, I'll be speaking as the character. There are many long hallways. How many, I don't know. Endless, it seems. I can't tell how long they are. They're poorly lit to save energy. As I walk down the hall, a region of light follows me so that I can see everything within my own region of the hallway. The region of light expands to about 100 feet in front of me and behind me. Beyond this light in both directions, the hallway fades into darkness. The region of light follows me, regardless of which way I walk. No doubt there are sensors that relay my position to a computer that controls the lights for my convenience. Walk down the hallway, light follows me, long hallways, darkness beyond the region of light in both directions. Now these hallways, they're spotless, not a speck of dirt. The air is filtered and kept at optimum temperature and moisture. The equipment is so efficient that not a sound can be heard from it. At first, I thought that the halls were completely silent, except for my own breathing, heartbeat, footsteps. But then I thought, and I'm not sure, I heard a faint hush and a deep rumble. Now, if there really are such sounds, and I'm really not sure, I know it's the sound of breathing, sighs, and heartbeats. You see, along each side of the hallways is a row of plastic capsules, and in each is a human being. As I walk down the hallway, an endless procession of encapsulated humans passes by on both sides, almost as though they are flowing past me rather than me walking past them. All of this occurs in silence, except for my own sounds and the possible hush and sighs and the rumble of beating hearts. Each human sits silently in a capsule, no more than a foot from the next. Everybody is healthy. Everyone is in the prime of life. It appears that optimum nutrients and preventative medication are fed through inhalation. Some sort of electrical field stimulates the muscles to keep them in condition. In some way, the aging process appears to have stopped. Disease has been eliminated. The possibility of injury, of course, has been eliminated. As far as I can tell, it may be that death itself does not occur. All of this life support system is automatically controlled through sensors that relay information to computers that control feeding, exercise, and whatever else is needed to sustain perfect health. As far as I can tell, perfect health is automatically available to everyone with no effort. Now, the order and efficiency of this system are really remarkable. But as I walk down the hallway in hushed and rumbled silence, it is the faces of the people that impress me. Everyone has a look of contentment, happiness, and fulfillment. Never have I seen such radiance expressed on people's faces. First, I feel exhilarated. I expect them to leap from their capsules and hug me and dance. But they don't leap out. They stay in their capsules, twisting their heads slightly as they nurture their smile, moving their bodies gently as expressions of their contentment, happiness, and fulfillment. I suddenly feel terribly alone. Their eyes always seem to look over my shoulder into the empty space of the hallway. I'm walking faster now. An endless procession of contented, happy, and fulfilled looks flows out of the darkness in front of me and shoots past me on both sides and then melts into the darkness behind. Let me explain the meaning of all this from the limited information that I have available to me, although I'm not an expert. As I have found out, each person in a capsule has complete controls available at all times. Through such controls, individuals can bring about any image and emotional state that they wish. Any image, any emotional state that they want. So there's no disagreement over imagery here. Take whatever one you want. I think that some sort of electrical field alters their brain waves, so virtually any experience can be placed in their minds. A computer controls this electrical field in response to the commands of the encapsulated persons. Feelings of love, compassion, fulfillment, meaning, significance, contentment, belonging, and optimism, and anything else are available on command. Feelings of pain, suffering, resentment, despair, guilt, anxiety, loneliness, emptiness, and fear are also available on command. But it appears that no encapsulated person selects these. From the looks on the endless faces, everyone has a positive outlook. But the choice for these more negative feelings, of course, is available. All sorts of experience can be called forth by each person. If you wish to experience love, compassion, and fulfillment in a mountain cabin with a warm fire in the fireplace, then the experience is available to you on your own command. All of the feelings, sights, smells, and sounds are placed into your brain. The people in the capsules don't imagine these things, they experience them. Now, I learned a little bit about the history of these hallways. Let me tell you a little bit about the history. In the past, sounds were available to people on command through radio. Then with television, picture and sound became available at the flip of a switch. Through sight and sound, one could experience adventure, travel, love, compassion, competition, and lots more. The number of television channels were expanded and personal home computers were added to enable more individual control. By such controlled experiences of sight and sound, but they found out that such experiences of sight and sound, they weren't personal enough. The experience of sight and sound was too incomplete. Later, emotions themselves were broadcast with the pictures and sounds. At first, this was attempted through background music. Then various forms of subliminal suggestion were added. Subliminal suggestion works in two ways. You can have messages that flash on the screen that you don't recognize that tell you you're thirsty, for example. You start getting thirsty. Or you're lonely, you can do that. Passionate, you can have those messages. And also with sound, they can put these low-level sound messages. They're putting them in storage now. Low-level sound messages to affect your feelings. This is state of the art right now. Okay, now, for the subliminal suggestion, there were objections to the use of subliminal suggestion, and I think you can understand why there would be objections to this. However, technology overcame these objections because these objections were overcome by allowing the individual viewer to select his or her own subliminal suggestions. Such individual control was made possible by interfacing the personal home computer with the television, with its expanded channels and videotape storage. Viewers could add pre-programmed packets of subliminal suggestions to their own viewing experience. Thus, experience through sound, sight, and feelings became more available for individual use. Later, more efficient ways of controlling emotional involvement were developed. Devices were developed to alter brainwave patterns so as to more directly control feelings. Feelings could be dialed and controlled along with pictures and sounds. It later became apparent that mere pictures on a small screen were too restrictive. With technological advancement, entire images, complete with smells, tastes, could be transmitted to the brain. Total experience was the goal, and the technology to produce this rapidly expanded. Now, at first, of course, total experience devices were a novelty, but their practical value soon became important. As an example, prior to the use of these devices, people traveled a great deal in order to have a wide range of experiences. With total experience devices, the experience could be brought to the person rather than the other way around. This more efficient transfer mode of experience reduced travel substantially. Consequently, natural resource consumption and pollution declined. It's more efficient. This was fortunate, because in this society, resource depletion and pollution had reached near catastrophic levels. There were additional efficiencies, and these were quickly realized. You see, the poor could experience wealth. The lonely could experience friendship and community. The guilty could experience forgiveness. Failures could experience success. Even the violent could experience violence without hurting anyone. Crime rates declined. Now, the early techniques, of course, had some limitations. All of technology, you have to work the bugs out. Now, the early techniques, they took a real person and placed him or her in an actual experience. Say skiing or fishing. The brain waves of the person in the actual experience were then recorded. These same brain waves could then be transmitted to any number of other persons, that is, receivers. We call the people receiving the experience receivers. And these receivers, in theory, could have the same experience. But this early method, it didn't work very well, because the original person who had the original experience, they had too many other feelings and memories mixed in with the recorded experiences. The people receiving the experiences would thus get terribly confused. In time, however, computers were able to filter out these background experiences in a complex procedure called decontextualizing. Thus, the essence of the experience could be inserted into the receiver's mindset. At first, this still resulted in difficulties because the experience might not fit the receiver's mindset. This difficulty was overcome by a contextual conditioning procedure that altered the receiver's mindset to permit the experience reception. The next breakthrough was experience enhancement directly through computer synthesis. Eventually, the original experiencer was not needed. The computer could combine different experience patterns in response to the control of the receiver, the person receiving the experience. Thus, the original experience was no longer limited by the actions of an actual person. The biomedical breakthrough brought about the next revolution. That little technological competition out there. Okay? Okay, but you see, you have to control your technology. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, now the biomedical breakthrough brought about the next revolution. Okay? Now the users of the total experience devices could be far more healthy and safe than non-users. We live in a safer world. In addition to becoming more experienced, users can remain youthful and beautiful through capsule maintenance. The objections of non-users declined, and eventually non-users died off. Through the use of robots, total experience devices were made available to everyone. Maintenance activities were taken over by the robots. This eventually led to the present system that I've described to you. Now, I must emphasize that the receivers in the capsules, the receivers are totally in control. They can and do adjust experience to meet their own personal needs. Each receiver is totally free to control his or her own life without infringing upon someone else. There is a total equality among all receivers. Yet, at the same time, any or all receivers can experience arrogance and privilege if they decide to. In fact, any or all receivers could experience being a king, emperor, or czar without infringing upon the freedom and independence of any other receiver. There is no violence of one person on another. Crime rates and war are non-existent. Love can be experienced without pain if a receiver decides for such an experience. The receivers are in charge. They control their own lives through the individual controls within each capsule. Any receiver can leave the total experience devices at any time, and provisions are maintained for those who might make that decision, though I am not aware of anyone who has. I don't know what experiences are now that these receivers are now having. You see, the experience synthesizer, the computer, was programmed to learn. You can, by the way, program computers to learn. The computers developed new patterns of experience. These were made available to receivers. Based upon the choices that the receivers actually make, newer and better patterns of experience have evolved. Thus, the entire system is progressive. It improves by responding to the expressed needs and decisions of everyone. Now, I look into one capsule after another. Endless capsules, but no capsule comes back to me. I see endless faces, one after another, always smiling, sighing, and looking past me into the empty space of the hallway. I am a stranger in this world, and I am uncomfortable in it. The The ecstatic faces, the smiles of pleasure, the sighs of contentment, they all dart past me as I quicken my pace down the hallway. I now find myself walking faster, running. At last I see something from within the darkness in front of me. It's a faint red light. I continue toward it, slowing down because of the shortness of my breath. The light grows brighter. I recognize it. I stop dead in my tracks. It's a simple exit sign, still beyond my region of light. I slowly walk towards it. Again, I notice the looks of contentment and fulfillment from the encapsulated persons. They're beautiful, so beautiful to miss even seeing a mere ordinary person such as me. They still look over my shoulder into space. I stand in silence and loneliness, breathing heavily. I try not to look at the endless rows of sighing, smiling bodies, but then something catches my eye. There to my left is an empty capsule, clean, open, and welcoming, an empty capsule surrounded by looks of happiness, contentment, and fulfillment. What experiences they must have. Certainly not the anxiety and emptiness that I feel. My imagination swims in fantasies. I could choose those experiences and more than I could ever imagine. I could be healthy, recover maybe even my youth. I could be in control. The empty capsule, clean and inviting, stands before me. And down through the darkness, beyond my region of light, is the exit sign. Now I ask you the question that I've asked my students. Should the character of our story get in the capsule? Stick with the story. Don't try to figure it out. What do you think? No.
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 No. It's the answer. That's the same response I get from my students. Oh, there's occasionally some that, well, maybe. Or it might be nice to try it for a little while. But even those are saying, well, I don't think so. But a lot of them just say, no, emphatic no. Really? That's the response. The next question, if you all feel that no, just feel that no, feel the conflict. And even if you say, well, maybe, feel a part that at least tells you, well, don't, you know, maybe I ought to think about this. Since practically no one says, yeah, jump in. Most of them say, no. Just like, be in touch with that no. That no. The next question. Why that no? Why not? Why?
It's empty.
You don't want to be constrained.
I'd like to find out what's available at the exit sign.
That's kind of an engineering approach. Let's study the benefits and cost of this thing.
Let's stick with the no, okay? Because it's easy. You see, what you can do is you can change the story. Say, well, maybe this is really bad, or maybe the system won't work, or stuff like that. And then that escapes the story. That escapes the paradox that you're facing. Let's stick with the paradox. It's all there, and let's not think about it. Let's stick with the no, okay?
I want to let go.
Let go of what?
Relationships, community.
An interpersonal relationship might be missing.
I don't want to be endlessly contented.
I'm not sure if you're the only one there, though. What do you have? Do you have relationships?
Do you want to experience love? You can experience it. If you want to experience good feelings, warmth, you can experience it. You want to experience, what kind of relationship do you want? In the capsule, you can get it.
No, but you don't have it. Sort of interpersonal relationships.
What kind do you want? Experience. You say, go in the capsule. I want interpersonal relationships.
You got to have another person in there with you.
Well, you can experience the other person. What's the difference between the experience of the person and the person?
Unlimited choice is the absence of choice.
Oh, Oh, this is, now there's an interesting paradox. Talk about a paradox. My students say that. They say if you have too much control, you lose freedom, which is essentially this. Now there is a paradox. Because usually we speak of freedom as I'm in control, right? I don't want anybody telling me what to do. That's what we call freedom. And choice means having options. And now we hear something different coming up. I'll get to you in a minute. But I want you to stick with the paradox that comes out, where engineers are saying, if you've got too much control, you lose freedom. Boy, now that is a paradox. Or, if you have too many choices, you don't have choices. Okay. Everybody says, yes, but when we say yes, let's be aware, we're saying yes to a paradox that's contrary to the normal way that we say things. Yes?
Yeah, it reminds me, I wonder if it's a biologist here, because it reminds me of some things that I've read about experiments being done with animals in which they are some kind of pleasure, whatever, their brain is stimulated, and they become addicted very quickly. They cannot stop. And it seems to me that the loss of, the only freedom is in the initial choice to go in the capsule. Once one is addicted, you lose freedom altogether.
Yeah, they can actually have mice, for example, and stimulate the happiness part of their brain at one end of the cage and put the food at the other end of the cage, and they starve to death.
They eat themselves to death.
Right. The technology is there. I think that's... Yeah. Let's not escape... Let's stick with us, though, rather than the rats, okay? Yes. Why not get in the capsule? Let's stick with that.
You wouldn't have any goal. You wouldn't have to make any effort to reach a goal.
What kind of goal do you want?
Well, we all set goals in every aspect of our life.
In the capsule, I want goal. I want my goal to be this, this, and this.
You don't have to work for it.
You don't have to work. You couldn't make no effort.
I want to do this kind of work. So you can experience that kind of work.
I don't think you'd have a choice to go to hereafter.
You got the hereafter, right? Isn't this a description of what a lot of people say heaven is? No, everything's nice.
You're saying weren't you saying in your introduction that the technologists or the engineers eventually come to the religious or something?
Well, aren't we doing this right?
Right,
we're doing this now. We're not using religious language. But what we're saying in paradoxes that are really kind of strange, like if you have too much control, you have no control. If you have too much choice, you have no choice. If you have too much control, you lose freedom. What we're really talking about is something important to vulnerability. Is that what we're saying? That's a strange thing. Now, I really prod the engineers more. I say, hey, wait a minute. Here's a world with no pollution, no resource depletion, no wars. What are you guys working for? Isn't that what you're working for? And you still reject it. You devoted your whole education. And they get more determined. Yeah, I'm rejected. You see the paradoxes, particularly for engineers, where your ideal, of course, which we don't always follow, obviously, is to provide a world where people don't have hunger, where people have safety, where people, those are all ideas, they're good ideals. But they're not enough. Yes?
I think the other thing is, quite as I said, there's something about, it seems to me that essential to life is randomness or chance, or?
Well, the engineers would say, you want randomness, but that's one of the easiest things to put in a computer. Right? I mean, random. I mean, they have random number generators, and you can expand those out.
But what would happen to me, now I'm going to say, what happens to me in the capsule is completely, it's not predetermined by the computer, but it's predetermined, you know, I absolutely determine what will happen to me, but in actual life, what happens to me, I don't determine.
You're vulnerable in real life.
Are we back
That's
to that?
Another way of saying you're vulnerable in real life. So really what you're choosing is vulnerability. You're saying there's too much control. And it's more than random, though, because you've had use in computers, and we can program in the randomness. If you choose randomness, how much do you want?
Yeah.
That's what they'd say in the capsule. You want more rims? Fine. How much you want? Turn it down.
Maybe suffering will come up today, and maybe.
Sure. You want suffering? You know, how much you want? You know? You want fulfillment? How much do you want? You want contentment? Okay. What do you want?
How much character can she plug into?
Well, what kind of character would you like?
Satisfaction from accomplishing something.
What kind of satisfaction do you want?
Really? I'm sensing an assumption and a question, and I think the assumption is that meaning is found in experience, period. And my question is, from whence do we find meaning?
Okay, so what you're saying, and I want to translate it back to the original question, why I wouldn't get in the capsule. You're saying there's something meaningless, or at least there's a risk of losing meaning. Okay, but let's stick to back to the question, why not to get. So there's a risk. Now, you also said something that my engineers said. They said, well, this isn't quite the right word. I can't remember the exact words you used. But you said, this isn't quite the right word. I'm going to sort of say what I mean. And you're using some body language. You see me, I'm using the body language. And I found that among the engineers, they would say, this isn't exactly what I'm trying to say, but I'm going to try it anyway. And in other words, what we ended up with was what Abraham Heschel says, all words become understatements. Okay, so the words are never quite enough. And they start using more body language, which engineers normally don't do very much. Okay? And they start using more body language. So that was one of the experiences. They started using things like you're saying, somehow meaning, somehow authenticity is lost, somehow, and yet the words that we usually have, like satisfaction, that wasn't enough. How much satisfaction do you want? And I say that to them. And the more I challenge them, and you can experience that yourself, when I said, you said, I don't know, one of you said, satisfaction. I said, fine, how much do you want? Okay? That probably frustrated you in one sense, because you probably became more determined not to get in the council rather than less determined. So the word satisfaction wasn't quite the right word either. Right? What we ended up here with some paradoxes. Let's just say, let's face it, we ended up with some paradoxes. Yeah, you want to say something?
You wouldn't have your meaning.
Your meaning.
Your meanness. You lose yourself.
You lose something about yourself. Now, this is very interesting. We're getting it. If you get too much control, you lose something of yourself. If you don't become vulnerable, it's unreal. If you get too much control, you lose freedom. If you have too much choice, you have no choice. You notice the paradoxes we're saying. And what we're saying in terms of the world, the technological world, the words we're saying, I mean, if we just walked out or someone, you know, came in here and heard us saying this, you might think a little crazy. You know, I mean, the idea, if you have too much control, you lose your freedom. I mean, we're taught that, you know, freedom means I'm in control. Capsule gives you all that, and we're saying, And what we're choosing, in reality, is vulnerability, and that somehow there's something essential about vulnerability. It's not that it's nice to be vulnerable, but there's something essential to our being. And even that word vulnerable, or authentic, or meaningful, that's not quite a good enough word. Okay? Does that fit your experience from the start? Fits your experience. Okay, I want to tell you one of the responses of one of my students. Okay? And I think, you know, we ought to listen to this student. I wouldn't enter the capsule, but if you ask me for a reason for not entering, I can't find the words. Any reasons that I give tend to sound religious, and I don't like that. You see, when someone comes up to me and talks about religion, I feel like they're asking me to get into their capsule. What can I say? Okay. Then the discussion, what capsules can we construct ourselves? Can language become a capsule? Okay. I think that's been what we've been talking about. own expectations become a capsule. And I like to think that paradox, or the cracks in the capsules of our own expectations, that's why paradox is so important. Okay. Now I haven't finished the story yet, so I want to continue the story a little bit. Stick with the story for a while. Okay? I better find out where I can pick up. So far, I've assumed in my discussion that you wouldn't enter the capsule, and I think that's what most people are saying. But now let's think about the possibility of entering and see if we can use the story to tell us a little bit about what the meaning of entering the capsule might mean. Okay, we'll continue the story. We'll assume someone has. I want to fill some of you in a little bit on the language in here, because I did write this for engineers. We, as human beings, they refer to us as carbon-based, but the carbon atom is largely what constructs us. In the computer, it's silicon. So a computer is a silicon system, and engineers would say we're a carbon system. And that's just a way that they're familiar with that. So I just want to brief you on that. Okay? Now let's take and imagine that the character has entered the store, entered the capsule. We sense that something very precious would be lost, or at least risk. The risk of loss is there. Okay? Something very important. Okay? Now let's see if we can come to some grips upon what that something might involve. What the choice to enter the capsule means by continuing our story. Okay? So let's go back and think about this system and say, what does the choice to enter mean? Now, it seems to me that I've looked at this capsule system with my engineers, and this is a technological system, you agree, the capsule system. And of course, it's programmed to learn, to make technological improvements. We said that it's a learning computer, the robot, so it's a technological system. So if we're going to learn the future history of this system, that's what I want to do, we have to look at it like a technologist. Okay, it's a technological system. And it seems to me that the weak point from a technological standpoint of the entire system are the carbon-based receivers, the human bodies. Now, as an engineer who's worked with computers, it appears to me that that eventually the weak part of this entire system, the carbon-based system, will eventually, the carbon-based receivers, human brains, and the bodies attached to them. That's the weak part of the system. It appears to me that efficiency and performance of these receivers could be improved by transforming them to silicon-based receivers, that is, computers. Receptivity to experience could be enhanced. The variety of experience could be expanded. Maintenance and repair would be far easier. Certainly the existing computers of this system, which are themselves silicon-based, they would be able to determine these advantages, and the robots could provide the services. The question is, would the carbon-based receivers choose to make such a transfer? I believe they would. After all, the transfer would be gradual, and each step of the transfer would involve tremendous subjective advantages, expanded experiences, new dimensions of feelings, and greater security. Those system modifications not accepted by the carbon-based receivers would, of course, be rejected. See, our system forces nothing on anyone. But then some options would likely be selected, and with time, the cumulative result of such choices would most likely lead to more effective silicone-based receivers. The consequence of such choices would be a computerized receiver system. Eventually, of course, the total experience system and the receiver system would become totally integrated. Human beings would have chosen themselves out of existence. And what is left after their choice? What has been brought forth and uncovered and revealed through such choice? All that is left are the devices of our own control. We as humans are gone, but the instruments of our use remain. These products, instruments, and devices are efficient, orderly, precise, and controlled. They will continue to serve long after humans have chosen themselves out of existence. But what will they serve? They serve the background, the technological background, that brought them forth. Control in the service of control. Order in the service of order. Efficiency in the service of efficiency. Use in the service of use. Power in the service of power. And what has been covered up? Human being has been covered up. Only the devices that they control and remain and use remain. Now imagine that this outcome has actually occurred. That is, a completely integrated computer system is now present. Of course, with engineers, this is a crisis, because they know that computers are nothing more than systems of switches, flipping, right? They're just flipping back. That's what a computer is. Very elaborate and efficient flipping of switches. Like switches, just like, you know, they're on your door. I mean, they're not just like that, but on and off switches. That's all that's left. But I ask you, if we assume that outcome has happened, I ask you another question. When did the humans of our story choose non-being? When did they make that choice? Was it when the last human brain cells were replaced by computer components? No, I think that the choice came earlier than this. But how much earlier? How far back in the history of our imaginary culture would we have to go in order to say, yes, here are real humans making real choices? As we go back in the history of our imaginary culture, we come closer to our own culture. Let us go back in the history of our imaginary culture to when the complete carbon-based receivers, the biological humans, were still in the capsule. This is the historical period that the character of our story described. Here we find biological organisms similar to ourselves. But have they already chosen non-being? It seems to me that they have, and it is only a matter of technological refinement before the biological organisms are themselves replaced. At this time, they are so much contained by their essential choice that the outcome of their non-being only needs to be worked out. It seems to me that the essential choice for our imaginary culture came earlier. There is good reason to believe that we must go earlier into their history. That is, we must come closer to our own culture to find out when the choice for non-being was essentially made. But how close dare we come? Could it be that we have already made the choice? Has the covering up of or has the bringing forth of non-being already begun? We may not end up with the same world as our imaginary culture. After all, history works itself out in surprising ways. The technology provides many options for humans to choose non-being. There are varieties of non-being open to humans. But if we trace the history of our imaginary culture, of our story, back to when they made their essential choices, will we not likely find a culture similar to ours? This raises serious questions. What does it mean to choose non-being? What does it mean to give up? What does it mean? There are some indications that we are already making those choices, maybe already have made them in all that needs to be worked out of the technological refinements. Let me read to you a quote from Newsweek magazine, August 24th, 1981. It's already outdated. Researchers report that the average family member now spends more than 7 hours a day tethered to the tube, and just 14 minutes a day conversing with others in the house. Other studies show that cable subscribers watch more TV than do their neighbors without cable. Futurists who put these findings together envision a nation of self-imprisoned videos. Passively dependent on the cable for most human intercourse, insulated from any ideas or experience, not safely prepackaged for home consumption. Mm-hmm. That sounds awfully close to the capsule. The question that we end up with is, how do we even talk about our choices? Philosopher William Barrett raises some questions. He raises this question. We may no longer be free for the kind of thinking that would redeem us from the world we ourselves have created. We may have made ourselves incapable of such thinking. I will not. But the story raises some questions. What does it mean to choose non-being? What kind of capsules do we construct for ourselves? And when confronted with the story of getting in the capsule, we chose vulnerability. That doesn't mean it's comfortable. And are we willing to continue that choice to accept the vulnerability? Or are we really looking for a nice, safe capsule? The essence of that choice is, are we choosing existence, or are we choosing ourselves out of existence? Now, I think that Holden, in a sense, tries to address that. And that's why our discussions end up quite often so unsettling. Because I think the people here are choosing vulnerability, even though we don't like it. It is an essential choice, and that's why we get together and we talk about questions and we get disturbed. Right? I mean, the questions we've had on changing the language. Those are disturbing questions from people on both sides. And we would like to have this nice capsule that would protect us from those. And I'm not saying that getting hurt is fun or good even. But the essential choice to choose the vulnerability, and then having made ourselves vulnerable by challenging each other, we go and celebrate at Vespers. I think the story that makes sense. The celebration is, of course, a celebration. It's not something to make us just feel good, even though we may feel good. And our faith had better not be a capsule, because remember, we rejected the capsule. But let's also remember that it's also very difficult to tell when we choose the capsule. Remember, we go back into the history. Those are the kinds of images I'd like to leave with you as you participate in these other discussions. Because I think these discussions are an acting out of the choice not to get in the capsule. Acting out of that choice. And we begin to sense, I think, a little bit the message that Christ gave us, because obviously the vulnerability was part of the gospel message. Joy and happiness, of course, is too, but the vulnerability is also. Okay, let's just open it up for questions or discussions. Yes?
Well, it just occurred to me that I sense another paradox in
good.
What you were talking about with entering the capsule, because as I try to get myself into thinking about that, I have the feeling that, you know, you picture that getting into the capsule is in the direction of choosing non-being. And yet, the paradox, I think, is that as we contemplate that, getting into the capsule looks like being in the direction of power. And there's something in my guts, at least, that wants power. I think we all have that in some sense. And that goes right back to the, contemplating this whole thing, goes back to the first chapters of the Bible, and the very primal paradox between the creature and the creator. And built into the creature is this desire to to achieve that power of the creator. So we go right back to that very primal theological conflict, I think, that we all strive to gain that power of the creator. Somehow, deep in us there is that, and yet our real being is our creatureness. And anything that we do that destroys our creatureness is going to cause us trouble.
Well, let me take the term power, because that's a very interesting one. Because we usually think of the bad of power is someone else has it and another group doesn't. And that is a bad, because there's oppression and injustice. But what the story has is everybody has the power, and there's still a bad because of too much power. And yet, at the same time, we don't want to just give up power in the sense of just kind of lay back. What I'm suggesting is that there is an act that's essential, which is what I call the sacrifice of power. That is, we are called to withdraw some of our power, not throw it away. And parents, of course, have to do that. If you see a parent who's trying to control their, fabricate a child to their own image, totally to their own image, okay, to their own specifications, they're not a very good parent. The true parent has to be more nurturing, which means you exert some of your power. The child tries to run out on the street, you grab that child, and you try to use power, but you also sacrifice power. You also deliberately say, I could do this to the child, but I'm not now, and you end up in the consequence of sacrificing that power, being vulnerable. And that's why the session next door is on parent burnout, because it is very painful. You can't put up with that? Well, jump in the capsule. But you chose not to. Yes?
It seems to me that we could call the story a retelling of the garden, and that there is an essential, there's an illusion about what you're going to get if you make this choice. And it turns out to be a hell. My question is, how does Jesus, our Redeemer, enter into the story? And how does Jesus come into the capsule and break the power of that capsule? I mean, I want to know if you have another chapter.
Well, there is one thing with a story or a metaphor. You don't want to push it too far.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you really have to watch it. So usually at the time I go here, I say, well, let's get out of the story. And one of the reasons I do this is because engineers will start trying to figure out whether the capsule work system will work. So that's a technological way. And as soon as you, there are a lot of science fiction stories, or some at least, that have something equivalent to the capsule system, and then it doesn't work. Well, that just escapes the whole point. And I just then the crisis of you making the choice to get in the capsule, if you assume it doesn't work, well, then it's easy to escape. So we can't push it too far. But the parallel of the creation story, I think that would be an interesting one to pursue. I think if we look at the life of Christ, it's full of paradoxes. It's full of paradoxes. And you have the importance of vulnerability comes across. But it's not a powerless vulnerability. There's still commitment there. Okay? So we live in this paradoxical world of vulnerability and commitment. And where it comes through to me, what happens after doing a story like this, all of a sudden some of the stories I learned in Sunday school start to have some meaning that I never thought of before, such as when Christ is in front of Pilate and Pilate asks him, what is truth?
Yes, hallelujah.
Okay? I expected, that what it should have done is given him an explanation, what is truth. That's what we usually do. We give explanations, words, rules, and so forth. You can program rules into computers. Very, very well. So a computer could have done that. And I used to think he didn't give an answer, but he did. He stood committed and vulnerable. And I think truth comes out of the practice, the history of people being both committed and vulnerable. Okay? It's a paradox.
I think it's really consistent with theology and cross-thinking, too, in terms of Christ or God coming as Christ and submitting to death on the cross, and that, in human terms, looks at like ultimate defeat and powerlessness and weakness is really the enthronement and the conquering point.
Yeah, right. That's good. And the temptation of Christ in the wilderness. I mean, here the devil is basically saying, why not make a capsule? I mean, that's one way you could say it. I mean, angels can do all of this, and why not do this? And he chooses not to.
For the sake of the story, I mean, I agree with you, David Mentor. You and I have talked about this already, that one of the great temptations of particularly clergy is to load up a metaphor until it breaks.
That's
make
right.
it into an allegory and nothing, and things that ultimately don't fit. But it seems to me, you know, I'm in your story now.
Okay,
and I'm thinking of a way to work in that system. And it seems to me that somehow or other Jesus would have to be, would enter that system and would choose all the things that nobody else chooses,
right.
You know, in order to be human, and then reverse the system so that the carbon system came back, or
yeah.
something
right.
like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could reverse the process, you kind of poke holes in some of the capsules. Not that all the things in the capsules are bad, but, you know, feeling good, happiness, and all the rest of that, but that those things can become demonic in a sense. They become the definition of the root itself.
Yeah.
And they encapsulate us. And that what Christ does is,
rips
open that the world is much bigger and much more wonderful than this capsule that we get within. And if we simply stay in that capsule, it shrinks until there's nothing left. Okay? And what we're really doing is liberated, from the capsules of that we ourselves construct. But this is a constant liberation because we're so good at constructing our capsules. And there's some good reasons for, the capsules aren't all bad. The purposes behind them, such as alleviating hunger and whatever else happens in the capsules. Those aren't bad things to do. But in the process of doing good things, we can actually encapsulate ourselves, and then if we can shrivel up into nothingness. Okay, and so then what we have in this constant renewal is this paradoxical renewal, this kind of a tearing away of our capsules, which sometimes is painful and makes us vulnerable, but nevertheless, it opens us up to a much bigger world. And it's
are you looking at Scripture as capsule?
Scripture can be capsule. It can very well be capsule. I think it very well could.
I think I see.
That could be. Now, I think one of the reasons why Scripture is so full of paradoxes is to make it difficult for us to make it into a capsule. I mean, if you try to make it into a nice, neat capsule, there's just parts that just don't fit together. Now, we tend to try to ignore that, say, oh, gee, we can't admit that there's inconsistencies like between the first Genesis story and the second. I mean, it can't both be scientifically factual. But maybe what's happening there, and I'm just throwing this out as a maybe, is that those paradoxes are essential so we don't construct this nice little capsule with Scripture. So Scripture kind of forces us out into beyond the capsules we may construct with Scripture.
Are you saying that within that, as you look at that capsule of first and second Genesis, are you saying that you need to change it?
No, I'm saying this. I'm saying if you look at Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, there are what an engineer or scientist would call contradictions. In one case, the animals are created, correct me if I'm wrong, before humans, and then second case, they're created after. Is that correct?
Okay.
Now, you can't be created in the scientific or technical world both before and after. It's either one or the other, okay? There's just no way that you can go ahead. Now, in Sunday school, what they did is they combined these stories, and I never knew that they were really two stories. They combined them into one story, parts of one, okay? But when you really read it, there's two stories, and there's paradoxes between them. Now, we in our scientific, technical world treat those as contradictions and almost define them as bad. We don't want to talk about them. However, from, I think, a more Jewish perspective, okay, those are paradoxes, okay? And what they do is they prevent us from constructing these nice, rationally consistent capsules. They always leave us with questions, which means we're not encapsulated by all our answers, okay? They leave us with questions, and we've had those questions here, and they're uncomfortable. You want comfort? Get in the capsule, okay? And the gospel scripture is saying, I am not going to be a capsule. Or at least it's trying to say that. And a lot of times, in order for us to make it a capsule, we really have to distort it. One of the ways of distorting it is trying to construct a nice, exact system. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. I think scriptures would try not to be capsules. But we can make them into capsules.